Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as Striketober has concluded, I said, look, love the fact that a lot of people are out demanding better wages, hours, conditions, a better voice on the job, better all of that stuff. And the number of strikes we saw, good. Hoping that that would go into November, and we'll still come up with, what is it, Strike November or Strike November or whatever. Had enough November, whatever. I'm now looking at there's a potential strike going to happen up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, the Scranton Federation of Teachers. There's talk that on November 3rd at 12:01, the pitch of the night, that the teachers there are going to go on strike, more than 800 teachers and paraprofessionals. And here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked Arthur Steinberg to come talk with us. Arthur's the president of AFT Pennsylvania. Arthur, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, anytime, Rick. I appreciate the opportunity.
So, you know, we've seen the memes, we've seen the hashtags. This is Striketober. Looks like this could carry over into November and December, and this could actually maybe pick up a little steam.
Oh, I think so. And the situation in Scranton is particularly, use whatever word you want, heinous, appalling. It just is beyond belief.
And this is one of those moments where, you know, at the end of the day, this, nobody wants this. No teacher. I've never met a teacher who's happy about going on strike. I've never met a worker who goes, yay, we're going to go on strike. It's great. I found people who go, I don't have a choice. This is the last arrow in the quiver. They've given us no option. This is the last resort.
Well, and Rick, this is particularly true here when you recognize that the educators in Scranton have not had a raise for 5 years. Their average starting salary is 470th out of 500 districts in the state of Pennsylvania.
Wow.
The district was placed in a recovery plan by the state in 2018. And what they have done is they have made draconian cuts to the educational program and have saved the money really on the backs of the educators. Every penny that they have tried to put into back into their coffers and to increase their balances have been at the expense of the educational program or the teachers. They cut a renowned pre-K program. They've increased class size. They want to stop paying for extra duties. And as I said, they haven't given the educators a raise in 5 years, where they are one of the lowest paid districts in the state.
This is crazy.
And they are the lowest except for one in their area.
This is crazy because all we keep hearing, Arthur, is that there's a teacher shortage all over the place, and we can't get teachers. The teachers aren't coming back. And I saw this meme the other day that made me go, here's probably why. This woman tweeted out that she's making more money as a bartender, working 15 hours less than she was making as a school teacher. And you go, what kind of a world do we live in when bartenders make more than the people who take care of our most precious resource, our children and the future of this country? It's bizarre to me.
Rick, it makes no sense, and it's particularly worse in Scranton. They have at least 40 teacher vacancies now, which means the class size has increased again, which obviously impacts the children's ability to achieve. Pennsylvania exports more of its teaching college graduates than stay, and it just becomes a vicious cycle, and the city of Scranton is paying the price. You can't have a vibrant city without a great public school system.
Yeah, you're not going to get people to move there. So whose fault is this? I mean, we love to blame people. Is this the fault of the school district? Is this the fault of the state legislature? Is this the governor's fault? Where's the blame in this, or is it everybody?
Okay. Well, the blame falls with, as far as I'm concerned, the Republican legislature won't adequately fund the schools. They have $7 billion sitting in a rainy day fund, and they could have put all of the money into the basic educational formula program, and they chose not to. And the school board and the chief recovery officer in Scranton is not utilizing the money properly. They've gotten $60 million from the feds in the past 3 years. It would be very easy to fund a justifiable, fair contract for the teachers. So I would lay the blame at the state legislature, at the feet of the state legislature, and the chief recovery officer and school board in Scranton.
Yeah, would you throw in Tom Corbett and the massive cuts from 2010? Would you throw that in there?
Oh,
as
that
well?
Started it. I mean, that started us down this path. But again, his successors in his party had an opportunity to rectify that now. And Governor Wolf has started to put all of the new money each year through the basic to fair funding formula. However, that legislature has denied him the opportunity to put all of the money through it, which is why the fair funding lawsuit has to go forward and is being heard. So put a capital R next to it with Corbett, the current legislature, and then, at least half of the blame also goes to the chief recovery officer in the school district in Scranton.
Now, I have a friend who lives up in that area, and he tells me that there are other schools, like charter schools and cyber charter, who have played into this. Is this playing into that scenario as well, or is that a minor?
Well, sure. No, it's not minor because you know how horrible Pennsylvania's funding is in relation to charters, how it just robs money from the traditional public schools. And as the situation worsens in Scranton, they're poaching kids from Scranton, which means that more money goes to the charters and comes out of the pockets of the school district.
I mean, there's a moment where you go, at some point you've got to make smart investments. And, this has been going on in the Scranton School District for a while. As you pointed out, they've appointed this overseer. And generally what I find out, and help me if I'm wrong, whenever one of those overseers is put in place, the education comes second to the penny pinching. Is this what I'm seeing
there? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And Rick, the research has shown, we've done quite a bit of it lately, that particularly in Pennsylvania, state takeovers do not succeed. Their main goal is financial austerity. They've had enough of austerity and bare bones budgets in Scranton. And if they don't rectify it soon, they're going to do irreparable harm to the school district, to the kids, the staff, and the city itself.
Now, I look at Philly and I look at Harrisburg. Where they put things in place, where we end up paying administrators a whole boatload of money that should have been spent in the classroom, and they still fail.
Well, and fail, I think, is I take umbrage usually at that word because that gets thrown back on the educators and the teachers. I think it's the administration and the state legislature has failed.
No, that's what I mean. The administrators are the ones that are failing. We're paying them a boatload of money.
Funding stream. Then we're on the same page there.
No, there's no daylight between us on this because I'm a firm believer and I want, elected school boards. I want parents to have say in what's going on, and I want educators teaching kids at the front of the classroom and not bean counters. And sadly, what's happened every time you get people tinkering in there who are looking at the numbers more than they're looking at how our kids are doing, we get problems.
Well, and again, just back to Scranton, I mean, and everybody's focusing on, and rightfully so, that the educators there are having, it's a great struggle to keep their heads above water financially, but the devastating impact that it's had on the educational program in Scranton can't be overstated.
It's sad, especially, when you're coming out of this pandemic and, there's going to be a lot of remedial work, I believe, that needs to be done. Let me ask you about that, because, I do believe there's going to be some remedial work that needs to be done, and we should be budgeting for that. And yet we can't seem to keep the lights on, it seems. We can't seem to pay just the basic bills. How are we going to go and do the work that needs to be done into the future as we continue to move back to what was considered normal in the past?
Well, I think this is a perfect example that you have to at least give them the basic necessities before you can deal with what everybody lost. And surprisingly, because of the really remarkable efforts of educators across the state, some of the kids have fared rather well. But in poorer districts like Scranton, which have less resources and which require more services to keep the kids up to par, unless you put in adequate basic educational programs, it's very difficult to deal with the deficiencies that occurred due to the pandemic.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Arthur Steinberg, president of AFT Pennsylvania. You know, we're talking a little bit about, you know, what's going on in Scranton, a potential strike on November 3rd, also a teacher shortage. Now, you know, I'm looking at...
Rick, let me throw something in about Scranton, which to me is maybe the most unconscionable thing I've ever heard. In the middle of what is still a global pandemic, the Scranton School District sent notice to the Federation that should the strike occur on November 3rd, and by the way, they are still negotiating, their health care benefits will cease immediately as of 12:01 that morning. Remember, many of those educators have kids that are students in the school district of Scranton.
Well, this is what employers do, don't they? It's the number one thing they do to starve people back to work and make them desperate, which, again, is another...
I tell you, I haven't seen it too often in the public sector, and particularly in the school system.
Well, it looks like it's coming there, doesn't it? But here's my question. You know, I'm watching all these school board meetings. I'm looking at the organizing that's going on of pushing this right-wing agenda, you know, under the guise of don't let a good crisis go to waste. It seems like there are those who want to starve our schools and our teachers for this idea that, well, in order to save them, Arthur, we've got to destroy them first so that they can take them over and remake them in the whatever bizarre Texas kind of way that they're thinking about.
Yeah.
Are you as afraid as I am that this kind of billionaire money flowing into these fake grassroots groups?
Very much so, Rick. Rick, they're using different issues now, but it's the same playbook they've done for years. Starve the schools of resources, then claim they're failing and privatize them.
Is that part of this?
Absolutely. That has been a consistent theme since this privatization voucher charter school agenda came into vogue. They're just using these newer issues now to galvanize support.
Right, because now you've got these people, you know, basically losing their mind, apoplectic over their children having to wear masks. Oh, I won't be able to see my child's beautiful smile. You know, nonsense like that. And all the while being the useful dupes for the billionaires at the top who are funding these grassroots groups who are these, well, euphemistically named grassroots groups who have the ultimate intention of destroying public education. And it's one of those
destroying
things where you're...
Destroying public education, yes, and making money off it for themselves.
And that's where I was going to go with this. I mean, you know, there's a lot of education money being siphoned off into these for-profit industries.
Yeah, and no better example than the charter industry in Pennsylvania.
So what can we parents do? I mean, I see these videos of, you know, basically just parents losing their mind over masks. And now I guess there's this representative from Texas who's identified 850 books that he thinks will, I don't know, bring discomfort to students or maybe give them ideas about sexuality or racism, that he wants every school in Texas to report to him if they're on the shelves and report any other bad books. I fear book burning's on the horizon. You look at this stuff, that's what they're organizing around. Not how do we make education better? How do we get more qualified and keep qualified teachers in the classroom? No, it's about nonsense.
And it's to really further their own agenda, period, beyond education, just their right-wing, intolerant programs.
So
you ask what parents can do, that they need to vote in their school board elections. This is a low turnout election coming up, and those well-funded groups take advantage of this so that they can get their supporters in and enact policies that, once you do surveying and polling on, you find out most of the public's not in agreement with. But if they control the local school board, then they have the opportunity to enact their programs.
Yeah, that's the frightening part of this. And all of this seems to be coming out of Texas, where evidently we're rewriting history books as we speak. And look, I fear...
It's Texas, Rick. It's the Koch brothers. It's all over.
Yeah, I fear at some point my kids may learn that January 6th was the most patriotic day in American history.
That's right. People stood up for the downtrodden, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Rewrite history.
No, and this is why voting is so important, and being active and engaged is so important, because the moneyed interest, they've got an agenda, and it's not the agenda that they keep throwing out in front of us. I go back to the old Jay Gould quote, I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. It doesn't even seem like they have to pay much anymore. We seem to be doing it to ourselves.
That they're disguising what they're doing very well, and people are fooled.
Yeah,
scary. Not everybody, but they, you know, the money is being used, unfortunately, very effectively.
Yeah, on the Scranton front, what can we do to help the teachers there in Scranton? I hope on November 3rd there isn't a strike. I hope that they get a good contract, that there's no disruption. But I also understand that at some point there's a breaking point and you have to do what you've got to do. But what can we do in the meantime?
Well, I think, you know, very superficially for right now, they have started a social media campaign for people to stand and support the Scranton Federation of Teachers. They can post on Twitter and Facebook. There are enough up there that they could like or retweet those. And that will let the interest in Scranton know that there is outside support for them, and let the teachers know that they have people in their corner so that they can persevere and weather through this.
Yeah,
and again, hopefully we'll be able to come to a negotiated settlement with them. The parties are working hard the Scranton Federation of Teachers is working hard towards that, and, you know, as we speak. And, you know, hopefully I'll be able to come back onto your show in a week and say, hey, we got a settlement that is fair for the educators in Scranton and for the students and their families as well.
I hope so. And I understand the hashtag that they're using is "We support our teachers." Hashtag "We support our teachers." Throw a note out, say you stand with the teachers in Scranton and teachers across the country, because ultimately, you know, as I've been saying, these are the folks that we entrust the most precious resource we have in this country, and that's our children and the future. If we hand this over to right-wing ideologues hell-bent on rewriting history, and teaching their version of, well, whatever, we got problems in the future.
I couldn't agree with you more, Rick.
Just is what it is. Arthur, I appreciate you taking time for us. Keep up the great work there at AFT Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the chance. I will talk to you soon.
Arthur Steinberg, president of AFT Pennsylvania. Again, you make sure you're tweeting out, hashtag, we support our teachers. Maybe throw in there why a teacher is important to you. Look, I've had some really great teachers over my lifetime that, you know, put me in a direction, on a path that made me, you know, the person I am today. You know, I can tell you, I respect teachers. Sadly, we have to put up with the garbage that we see. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day workers at International Harvester went out on strike. At the time, it was the UAW's longest strike. 35,000 UAW members at 21 plants in 8 states downed their tools. For 172 days, Harvester workers walked the picket lines over seniority rights and forced overtime. They had long resisted mandatory overtime rules. Workers at Harvester were the only UAW members anywhere who still enjoyed the 8-hour day, 5-day work week. They had no intention of giving that up, especially in the industrial downturn of the period that threw over 100,000 auto workers out of their jobs. Harvester argued the company had lost $1.3 billion in recent years because of work rules. The company hoped to force a concessionary contract. But 6 weeks into the strike, the company announced a 98% increase in profits for the year. 3 months into the strike, Harvester hinted it would drop its demand for forced overtime in exchange for part-time hires that would be non-union. The company also hoped to do away with seniority rights in job bidding. Despite injunctions that limited picket lines, strikers were able to minimize scabbing and shipments in and out of many plants. At a plant just outside Chicago, strikers striking Local 6 members marched outside company offices with a burning effigy of hated Harvester president Archie McCardle, chanting no forced overtime. Victory finally came in April. Harvester workers stood tough for months against company attacks in a period of massive plant and mill closures across the country. They secured seniority rights in job bidding and beat back attacks against mandatory overtime. As for McCardle, brought in to slash and burn the union workforce, he was fired.
So I got to tell you, you know, on the education front, you know, there's so much, man. So much. And the organizing of beating up public education is going on for years. You go back to Eli Broad and the Broad Foundation and how they can starve the beast and close public schools and charterize them and privatize them and profitize them. Because understand, these people don't do it out of the goodness of their heart. No, no, no. It's all about the money. It really is. It's about the money. And it's not just about the education part of it. It's about the buildings. It's about the maintenance. It's about, you know, the curriculum, the tests. You know, the tests that we have to give our kids every year, those high-stakes standardized tests. There's a profit motive to them. The fact that you can get those in there, we make money off of each one of those kids. You know, I had someone tell me that, you know, in the charter schools, they don't look at students. You know, they look at them as $10,000 there, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. Every little head that walks in the door is money. Now, some of them do okay. Some. Most of them don't do any better or any worse. And some do much, much worse. Some are like criminal enterprises where people have been locked up and thrown in jail and should be. But you look at the cyber charter stuff. Wow. And fortunately, if the pandemic did anything, seriously, if the pandemic did anything, it made us aware of how bad cyber charter education really is and how maybe it's not the future. And it made me feel a little better going, you know what? I don't think parents are going to put up with it. I don't see it as what is coming. Just throwing that out there. Some good news come out of the National Labor Relations Board. Who? You know, the people who oversee the National Labor Relations Act, the enforcement arm of the act. What they came out with is, you know, during the time of October 1st, 2020 to September 30th, 2021, the National Labor Relations Board recovered over $56 million in back pay and fees. Compare that to the fiscal year prior, during the former guy's term, and it was only a little over $39 million. So a huge jump in the amount of restitution being paid to workers who have been illegally fired because employers have, you know, have gotten bold. And I look at this and I'm going, you know, this is why I voted for Joe Biden right here, to make organizing a little easier. Look, the part of me, what I want the most for me in the Build Back Better plan is the help to get workers able to organize. Because here's what I believe. And I've been beat up for this in the past. You mean you don't want to give, you know, children an extra $250 a month? Yeah, I do. But you know what I would rather do? I would rather their parents make an extra $500 a month in their paycheck by having better wages. I would rather their parents have an extra $1,000 in their paycheck. I would rather their parents do better at work so that they don't have to ask government for a handout. I would rather have an environment where people get good, solid, stable, family-sustaining wage union jobs with good health care, good working conditions, and some bit of retirement security than a government handout. I've told you before, and I'll say it again, I'm against handout programs for the most part. I want jobs programs. I do believe in the therapeutic qualities of work. I do believe if you want to eat, you got to work. I do believe everybody wants to work. Just a matter of ensuring that there is enough employment for them. And what we know is the private sector is never going to create enough jobs. Either because they can't or more likely they won't. Because why would you want the competition that they're going through right now of having to deal with working people who are going, nope, not taking crappy jobs. You're going to have to pay more. I say we need to have government as the employer of last resort. To me, that's what should be in the Build Back Better plan. That would be a good start. But, you know, this is okay with me. I'm I'm happy to see the NLRB doing its job, moving forward on its mission. And I think next year you're going to see more. And then what I'm hoping is we don't see hardly any. And you go, well, what do you mean, Rick? Why wouldn't we see hardly any? Because maybe employers will stop illegally firing people. And maybe, because especially if we put those fines in place, $100,000 per violation, or $50,000 per unfair labor violation, and $100,000 for every time you fire a worker, which now they're the number they've put, 6,307 workers were put back to work. Do the math at $100,000 per. That is a nice chunk of change. And then put into place the fines that would go into paying the worker, not just the crummy setup that we've got now, to where if an employer like Amazon, for instance, because this just happened, fired two of their workers because they had the audacity to say that Amazon wasn't doing enough on the climate front, and they fired the both of them. Well, they brought them back eventually, promised to never fire them again, but then settled for them to go out the door. All they legally had to pay was their back pay, minus whatever they earned in the interim. So from the day they got fired to the day they were supposedly brought back, whatever they earned in between is subtracted from whatever they were supposed to earn while being an employee. And you go, how many people can get by on zero income that would make that penalty real? Most people go back to work and they get somewhere near the same wage. I've actually known people who've done better and didn't go back at all. So there's no penalty. There's no disincentive. For me, having an NLRB that's going to actively and aggressively go after people who illegally fire, and then having a dog with big teeth to take a big chunk out of their behind when they do illegally fire someone, that's what I want to see. I want a deterrent. Cop on the beat, deterrent, so that they don't do it anymore. And that there is an even playing field, that there is a way for workers to then not be afraid and harassed and intimidated for standing up for their rights. So good on the NLRB. Very, very happy to see that. And look, this is another reason why we need the Build Back Better plan to make organizing just a touch easier. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
We are still on track for climate catastrophe.
Mind the gap. A new UN report finds massive emissions gap between where we are and where we need to be. Plastic could become a bigger polluter than coal by 2030. Plus,
it'll give a boost to consumer confidence and acceptance of EVs.
Rental car giant bets big on electric vehicles.
I like big bets and I cannot lie. All of those big bets and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Bomb cyclone, yes. Bomb cyclones, because that's what weather is now. Just a combination of terrible things. So get ready for next week's forecast of murder typhoon, stabicanes, and the rest of the week is floods that try to explain Bitcoin to you.
Oh, no. Oh, that's the worst. This is your Green News Report.
I don't care what blockchain is. Stop trying to explain blockchain.
Okay, Desi Doyen, the oil industry is grilling the rest of the world. Seems only fair that their own CEOs would get a grilling in Congress.
Yes, it does. As we go to air, House Democrats are grilling executives from ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, and Shell about investigations that exposed how the companies have known since at least the 1970s that their products could cause dangerous man-made climate change, and then spent millions to deny the science, mislead their shareholders and the public, and block legislation to address it.
Go get them, please.
Meanwhile, congressional Democrats are still hard at work trying to reach a budget deal that includes as much climate action as coal state Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia will allow.
That's pretty much nothing.
Manchin's time-wasting maneuvers and demands to gut climate policies in the Build Back Better Act have seriously weakened President Biden's hand at the big UN climate conference in Glasgow, where the U.S. will be trying to convince other nations to cut their greenhouse gas emissions even faster.
I wish them luck.
And new polls show that 6 in 10 Americans of all political stripes believe that the pace of global warming is speeding up, and 55% want Congress to pass a bill to ensure that more of the nation's electricity comes from clean energy.
Yeah, well, if we did things because most Americans wanted them, we wouldn't be the United States of America.
In advance of the climate conference, Australia, a major coal exporter, announced a target of net zero emissions by 2050 with zero details on how it plans to get there.
Magic.
China, Saudi Arabia, and Russia also announced net zero targets for 2060. And it matters because the UN's new emissions gap report released this week finds that the world is dangerously off track between where nations are on emissions reductions and where we need to be.
We are really screwed.
In a press conference, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on all nations to strengthen their climate pledges.
We are on track for a catastrophic global temperature rise of around 2.7 degrees Celsius. Now, even if the announcements of the last few days will materialize, we would still be on track to clearly more than 2 degrees Celsius.
Totally fake accent.
Now, the report finds that current pledges would only reduce global greenhouse gas emissions by 7% by 2030, but cuts of 30% by 2030 are the minimum necessary to avoid overshooting the Accord's 2-degree target. Scientists warn that more than 2 degrees Celsius of global heating would trigger profound global changes like deadly extreme heat waves, water shortages, global crop failures, and ecosystem collapse.
As opposed to what's going on right now.
In other news, a stark warning about plastic pollution. As the world moves away from fossil energy, the oil industry is trying to extend their profits by pushing to expand plastic manufacturing, which uses oil. A new report from nonprofit Beyond Plastics finds that if current trends hold, the plastic industry's greenhouse gas emissions are on track to outpace emissions from coal by 2030, effectively canceling out global efforts to slow climate change.
Have I mentioned within the last minute or so how screwed we are?
Finally, a bit of good news. Car rental giant Hertz announced this week that it will buy 100,000 electric vehicles from Tesla, accounting for more than 20% of Hertz's global fleet, and that it will add thousands of EV charging stations to its rental locations. It's one of the largest purchases of battery-powered cars in history and the latest sign of the car industry's shift to electric vehicles.
I like those signs. Very nice. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, good or bad, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, Apple, Google, or Amazon Podcasts. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Well, looks like she's tested positive for the coronavirus. She's going to be working from home for the next 10 days during her quarantine. She said she's experiencing symptoms, but they're mild. Mild thanks to the vaccine. Evidently, she hadn't been in contact with the president. And this is one of those things. I had a bunch of people going, you see Joe Biden not wearing a mask around all those other leaders? And I'm going, you know, if there's anybody who's been tested more on this planet than those people, I don't know who they are. But those 20 leaders, you know that they're being tested constantly. and everyone around them is being tested. So I kind of think it's okay if they, especially since they're all vaccinated. Just a thought. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Maybe some news from Glasgow. Maybe something of it's a minute to midnight, according to Boris Johnson. I've asked my good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
So Jen Psaki's got it.
Yep. She had her booster shot, too. Of course, you don't know when she got the booster shot. It doesn't say, at least what I read. And, Rick, between what time she got her second shot, you know, and then the virus and the booster. Or did she give the booster, then the virus? I don't know. You know, but her symptoms are mild. But, you know, it still can be transmitted, and we know that.
So. I'm waiting for somebody, Bob, to tell me, see, the vaccine gave it to her.
Well,
I'm waiting for it.
I hear that. I know. I mean, in fact, on Facebook, I haven't gotten my booster yet. I'm about to get it with my dad. He's 98. But when I got my first and second shot, I posted, of course, and said, you know, do which is one. I got my shot. And then people said, you wait and see how that turns out.
Yeah. Well, all right. Yeah. I had a guy call me a sheep the other day for being vaccinated. I go, here's what I know. I know 90% of the people in our hospital system, because they just said it on the radio, who are hospitalized with COVID are people who are unvaccinated. I know that 90% of them who are dying are unvaccinated. So you keep it up, buddy. Maybe you'll be one of those statistics, too.
Well, there was a story about in Vermont. I do Vermont radio, and, you know, it was big. I think 80% vaccinated in the state, et cetera. Then there was a news story, and I sent it to the guy, you know, I do his show, and we were talking about it. Again, there's a surge in Vermont because it's a surge amongst the unvaccinated. So you have to read the article. Otherwise, it looks like 80% vaccinated and there's a surge. Well, it's because it's amongst the unvaccinated.
Yeah, and I'm okay with that. That's how you thin the herd. There's a point at which you go, hey, we've told you everything you need to know. It's on you now. And you know, better luck next time. And I hate thinking like that because I think it's bad for my karma, but I got to be done with it at this point.
Right.
Let's talk about crazy. Evidently, our U.S. Supreme
Court. Which one?
Which crazy? Evidently, our Supreme Court's going to take up the Texas abortion case.
Yes, they are. They are going to take up two of them, actually. But yes, the Texas law, which virtually ended, you know, abortion. And it was after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Then you got the tell on your neighbor provision in it, as they call it. But the justices started arguments today in two cases where the abortion providers or the Justice Department can mount federal court challenges to the law. Now, that's usually what they're saying. It's an unusual enforcement scheme. Then the defenders say, well, it'll shield it from federal court review. But it's really not so much the right to the abortion, but they're going to hear the specifics, since it's all legalese, but motivation for the lawsuits filed by the abortion providers and the Justice Department. And they're saying that the Texas law conflicts, of course, with the landmark Supreme Court Roe versus Wade. And that's going to be what they're going to zoom in on first. And then, of course, the Mississippi case.
So is it possible that they leave the six-week thing in there and they take out the enforcement, the bounty hunter part of it, and we end up with a situation where now the Supreme Court has ruled that it's not 20 weeks anymore, it's 16, it's six?
That's possible. And because they are, again, they have stated that they are going to look at the jurisdiction aspect of it, which brings in Justice Department, you know, or the state. So it's very possible. I don't know. They're hard to predict, but you never know. That could be part of it.
Boris Johnson at the COP20 climate talk said, it's 1 minute to midnight, and we need to act now. He says we have to move from talk and debate and discussion to concerted real-world action on coal, cars, cash, and trees. That's Boris Johnson saying that.
Right, who is right, of course, right to the right in the sense of political, but
correct.
The whole thing was, you know, first of all, China and Russia didn't have their leaders there, you know, which says a lot. And the second thing is that Johnson makes, I think, a valid point. Time is running out, but overall, though, if you look at so far, you know, of what they've done in Glasgow, I would say, what have they done in Glasgow? I'll put a different reference out there that way grammatically. What have they done?
Nothing.
Nothing. He's right on the alarm button, but I didn't see anything that led towards, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is the treaty. This is how we implement it. This is the timetable. This is what, the countries do. And again, Russia and China didn't even bother to show up with their leaders.
Yeah. And we did nothing at the G20 either. I mean, they didn't come out with any real, final communique that's going to move us to zero carbon emissions by 2050. There was really nothing that came out of that. So going from Italy to Scotland, just a bunch of nothing. And look, you look at the U.S. How can we take a position of leadership when we can't simply do the simple things that are in this Build Back Better plan to address climate change that I think most people like me would agree aren't going to do a whole lot?
Well, I think the precarious problem for President Biden, now on a positive side of the G20, he reversed some of the attitude that Trump had, all right, amongst our allies. That was refreshing for them, frankly. And he has reversed some of the policies, tariffs specific to Europe, which has never really been a problem. The tariffs in China he's kept, so that's a good thing. So, he's on the global stage. He's done some of the reversals of what was causing heartburn with our colleagues overseas. But on the other hand, you're 100% right, what's not done back in the United States. And it, of course, puts him in a precarious situation that, he's over there. He's saying we need to have leadership, this and that. And back in the United States, amongst his own party, because he's not getting any Republican votes, but amongst his own party, he couldn't get a consensus because of their internal fights, as I always call it, the circular firing squad. Either party does it. So, yeah, that's a problem for him. It's not the best position to be in when you go over and you're a new president and you can't get the initiatives that everybody's talked about.
Yep.
And one of them is an initiative in America to help the society, and so he's overseas talking about helping the world society. It was a tough time for him.
And I thought that Joe Manchin's timing to have his press conference right while the president's in the middle of all this was kind of a good jab in the back, which leads me again to the position where I started from months ago, and we've talked about this. I fear we get nothing out of any of this other than the kind of rancor and kind of division and kind of circular firing squad that I had feared.
Well, I was it was funny. I was over today getting a battery for my car key fob, and as I went over to get the battery, I saw Manchin on television, and so I ran over, obviously right away and caught it. And I was watching the faces of some people in that were sitting in the lobby watching it, and people were just kind of stunned. And I think in particular because Manchin, who said, I'll do $1.5 trillion, then said, okay, $1.7 trillion, because he did confirm that.
Yep.
And President Biden took it in that direction, in good faith, of course. And then I stood there today watching him basically say that he wouldn't accept $1.7 trillion for another reason, that it's the budget buster, it's this, it's that. Why would you? And well, it's also a scheme. The funding is a scheme. And I thought, there's got to be an intention, behind this to do it. And I think, I'm not going to call it a rare press conference, but I would call it it would be kind of unique at this point in time to do that press conference, because there's been back and forth press inquiries on this whole issue, as you and I know. You've been covering it for months. We both have. But all of a sudden, this was about him not bowing to party pressure to support more progressive social spending.
Yeah,
and they called it shell games and budget gimmicks. So that's sort of not like I'm having a problem. That is, I'm sinking the boat.
Yeah, you sunk my battleship. Absolutely. And yeah. And what's worse about it is you had a couple of progressives, and I look at Ro Khanna, the representative from California, who then came out this weekend and said, "Yeah, I'm going to support this because we need it." Basically kind of, swallowing the hard pill that is what would now turned into a poison pill.
Well, right, because the whole premise was, and I know some people went in different directions, the centrists versus the progressives, progressives versus the centrists. I understand that. But the whole position was one bill was going to move, and then it stopped, and then two bills were going to move. And then they went from $3.5 trillion to $1.7 million, or trillion to move that piece of legislation. Let's say almost simultaneously, not the same vote, two separate votes in the same period of time, right?
Right.
That was the whole game plan. That yesterday, if I was doing your show, I think we both would have said, yes, that's, you know, going to have some bumps and some hurdles, but that's what's going to happen. Now, I don't know that that's going to happen because the whole thing has shifted to where it looks like there won't be a $1.7
trillion. Yeah, and this is where, now, you know, I look at Progressive Caucus President Head Jayapal. Who everyone was saying, you just got to negotiate in good faith. This is where I go to her. She knows, evidently knows, there's no good faith there because this was a break in that good faith. This was basically saying, you know, I'm going to vote for the, and not only did he say he wasn't going to vote for the Build Back Better plan, but wagged his finger and basically said that you progressives have got to move forward and I'm not going to be pushed into voting for anything else. And you got to vote for the bipartisan bill. Which was, you know, kind of just a if it wasn't bad enough that you came out against one, to kind of throw that shot in there was kind of another.
Right. There's also some internal politics here because Senator Coons, Democratic senator from Delaware, his quote was basically, there's quite a few of us are going to continue to press our friend and colleague. You know how you stand on the floor of the House and,
sure,
oh, my good friend from Massachusetts, and then you attack them.
Right.
But when Coons said this and some other comments, there's another problem here. There's other fish to fry in that Senate.
The entire Republican Party.
Right, but now they're sitting back and letting the other people, the other side, be on fire. But I'm also, yes, you're right. That's something they have to deal with. But also they have bills coming up, and they have the John Lewis bill, but you know they have the voting rights bill and some other things coming up. So I think some of those comments that Senator Coons and others make are not because they're afraid of Manchin as much as they want to watch, because there are going to be some other votes, and they're trying to make sure he just doesn't totally run off, you know, I think.
Yeah, but I've been saying for a while now, if we had a functional democracy, Manchin and Sinema wouldn't matter. You would have enough Republicans who go, you know what? We've got seniors in my state that need vision and dental and hearing care. We've got, you know, kids going off to college that could really benefit from free community college. We've got, you know, children who could use that you know, the pre-K stuff. We got families who could use that $250 to make sure the kids could eat. There was so much in there that could help constituents in their state that they're just going, nope, none of it. We'll have none of it. And that's crazy. That's not only crazy to me, but it's dangerous that one party is and has gotten a pass for it. This is the part that bothers me, Bob. Nobody is going up to these Republicans. Yeah. Nobody's going up to Mike Crapo or Kevin Cramer or Ted Cruz and going, hey, why are you against kids getting $250? Why are you against granny getting chompers? None of that.
Well, you know, I rethinking this, woulda, coulda, shoulda, there might have been a better way to build a mousetrap with the Republicans. There might have been. And that would have been to have prescription drugs lowered, and also the Medicare portions and a couple of other things, and you take it in a piece of legislation, you get it to the floor, then you do the amendment process on a lot of other items. Once you get past the 60 threshold, then you do the amendment process on college education, et cetera, et cetera. They might have gotten a few votes on that, okay? But the Republicans are able to sit back and say, oh, $3.5 trillion, oh, my goodness. And now, of course, what they'll say is, well, you're complaining about me? Well, look, it's a Democrat here, a couple of Democrats that don't want this. So the Republicans, for now, have maneuvered themselves into the jackpot seat because they're sitting back,
yep,
you know, and letting this all transpire, offering nothing. But when did they offer something on the Health Care Act? ACA?
No, they all they wanted to do was take it away. They just wanted to kill
nothing.
It. There was no replacement. There was repeal. There was no replacement. I'm still waiting for the replacement.
Right. So they offer nothing. In this case, they're offering nothing. But they're kind of getting a pass because this is all internal. I think the only thing that saves this, the only potential thing that saves this is going to be the ability of President Biden to, you know, do something with Manchin.
Yeah,
probably, I don't see Schumer able to do anything.
He'll just put his glasses down to the tip of his nose and wag his finger.
I don't see any. In fact, Schumer's been, when do you last hear his name?
Today. He's going to move on the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act.
And that's why you just made the point. That's why they're a little bit iffy on Manchin now of hitting him too hard from the Senate side.
But that's not going to pass either, because Manchin's bill didn't pass. If you remember, Manchin had a plan that he said was going to get 60 votes. They rewrote the For the People Act for Manchin. Manchin, and look, there's some good things in Manchin's version that I'm not against, but they completely chucked the For the People Act, and now we've got the Freedom to Vote Act, which passed the House in May and then got filibustered twice in the Senate. It's not going anywhere. So the John Lewis Act ain't going anywhere either.
Yeah, they keep thinking it is. They keep trying to woo Manchin on it. So I don't know. This one, I honestly didn't see this one coming, that it would get to where it has gotten to today. And what I mean by that, Rick, is I thought there'd be some back and forth. But at some point in time, I didn't think that Manchin would upend today the entire, and that's what he did, the entire Biden agenda for this year.
Yeah. See, from the beginning, I was in the, they're going to screw this up, that we're going to get nothing. And I've been saying this. I hope I'm wrong. And I still hope I'm wrong, Bob. But, you know, this is it. And look, this is going to be Biden's ACA. He's not going to get all the things that he needs or anything, and going to take a beating for it in the midterms.
Well, you know what's sad about it, when you say, you know, it's Biden's ACA, you know, at least President Obama got the ACA.
Yeah.
Now, I will admit, some of the Democrats handled it wrong. They took the bait from the Republicans and started to say, well, maybe we need to, you know, do this or that. They should have just defended what they did.
Lieberman, Max Baucus, yep.
Yeah, right. But, you know, it's an interesting point because, yes, Obama took a lot of heat for it. Now they may have a bill, think about this, that they don't get, but they still take the heat for it.
No, that's
which is worse.
That's a fear. Going to be interesting again to see how this continues down the road. And I still am hopeful that something comes of it, but I'm not optimistic.
I'm not optimistic. I was a week or so ago. I really was, but now I'm just not sure.
There you go, Bob. As always, I appreciate the time, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend, former Ohio Congressman, political analyst Bob Nay. Let's take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that bringing in a scab driver to run an elevated train in Brooklyn, New York, ended in tragedy. Members of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers were out on strike against the Brooklyn Rapid Transit Company. The company had fired several union members for wearing union pins. To keep the trains moving, the company hired replacements and put them to work with little preparation. Edward Luciano received far less than the 60 hours of training that operators typically received before he made his fateful run. The next day, the New York Times reported on the deadly results, writing, quote, "A Brighton Beach train of the Brooklyn Rapid Transit Company made up 5 wooden cars of the oldest type in use, which was speeding with a rush hour crowd to make up lost time on its way from Park Row to Coney Island, jumped the track shortly before 7 o'clock last evening on a sharp curve approaching the tunnel at Malbone Street in Brooklyn, and plunged into a concrete partition between the north and southbound tracks. At least 93 people died. Some estimates were more than 100 killed. The operator and several company officials were eventually put on trial for manslaughter. No one was found guilty. The company did, however, pay out damages to some of the families. Negotiations between the company and the union would continue until 1920. The union eventually won most of its demands. In the years after the crash, new safety measures were implemented for elevated trains to help guard against human error.
Oh, the workers on the SP line, the strike sent out a call. But Casey Jones, the union's cabbie, wouldn't strike at all. His boilers, they was leaking.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, one of the great regrets I have in doing this show over the years, and in all 16 years that we've been doing this, one of the great regrets that I have was not getting Utah Phillips to come do our concert series here when we were back, you know, a number of years ago when we were doing labor concerts and doing a lot of organizing and bringing people together. We had a chance, and I just didn't have the money at the time. And he passed away two years afterward. And it's one of those things, you know, a great messenger. And I love his music. And you heard that in the last Labor History in two. Again, you know, one of those things you go, man, I should have done it when I was going to do it. But like they say, 2020 is history. You know, how's that go? 2020 hindsight is 2020. That's where we are. Interesting bit of statistic coming out. Researchers at the Public Religion Research Institute, they found that, this is a weird thing, 30% of Republicans agree with the statement, because things have gotten so off track, true American patriots may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. And they weren't the only ones. You had 11% of Democrats, 17% of independents. I would throw most of those independents into the Republican side of things because they're the libertarian folk mostly. I would have expected that number to be a little bit higher. Overall, 18% of all Americans agree that we may have to start slugging each other in the streets. Wow. Among people who believe the 2020 election was stolen, 39% of them believe that violence may be required. And this is kind of a scary thing. Because I got into one of these moments where somebody was throwing it out there and, hey, Brandon, and I responded and it almost came to fisticuffs. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, therickssmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, the Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone, take the program on the go, wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Ralph Waldo Emerson told about a guest who came to dinner and spent the entire evening prattling about his own integrity. The louder he talked of his honor, Emerson wrote, the faster we counted our spoons. Today, America has not one but six guests in our national home babbling about their integrity. They are the six extremist Republican judges who now control our Supreme Court, and it's a bit unsettling to hear them go on and on, almost frantically pleading with us to believe in their judicial impartiality. For example, the court's newest member, Amy Coney Barrett, suddenly blurted out at a public forum in September that, quote, "This court is not comprised of a bunch of partisan hacks." Whoa, better count our spoons. In fact, each of the six were installed on the court by right-wing Republicans specifically because they had proven to be devout partisan hacks. Interestingly, Barrett made her unprompted and strained assertion of judicial integrity at the McConnell Center, named for Mitch McConnell, the rabidly partisan GOP senator who pulled a fast one last year, rushing Barrett onto the bench on a party-line vote just before the Republicans lost control of the Senate. Indeed, old Mitch himself introduced Barrett at the forum where she gave her "We Are Not Partisan Hacks" speech. He grinned proudly at the pure hackery of his partisan protege. This is Jim Hightower saying, another hardcore partisan on the court, Sam Alito, whined in October that critics accused the court's GOP majority of being, quote, a dangerous cabal that resorts to sneaky and improper methods to get its way. Well, golly, Sam, yes, we do think that, because again and again, you partisans sneak up on the Constitution and we the people to twist the law to fit your political bias and personal whims. If you don't want to be considered political hacks, stop being political hacks. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.